That's not right at all. On community health improvement through community development and the village at Market Creek, and I suspect that this will be another great example of what we've been trying to discuss today. This microphone will stay up, so beware.
Yeah, and it's very tall for us vertically challenged folks. Thank you, Tony. Tony mentioned that a couple of his colleagues up here were, he could vouch, were great public health minds. I'm not one of those. I'm the third. I just want a disclaimer up front. I am not a doctor. I am not a nurse. I am not a public health professional. I'm not even a researcher. I loved your line about language, because every discipline has its language, and so I may not even speak your language. And you can, you know, wave me down if this becomes problematic. I do remember, because the story of Market Creek is about a community deciding to reclaim a brownfield and to get a grocery, get a mainstream grocery is how it started. But it got on a roll with its working teams, and eventually we won the right to go public. It took 6 years, three tries, before the Department of Corporations approved this very pioneering IPO. But the project is now owned by 450 community residents and a community foundation that operates at the neighborhood level, pumping those profits back into the community. And when we were going through the IPO, I used to just, I really had to learn how to translate between these disciplines, because I would have to go to one team meeting where reggae was Jamaican music, and, you know, you had to, you know, understand where you were. And if I went to the next team meeting, reggae stood for Regulation A, which governed the sale of security. So I very often had to, like, okay, which what language am I speaking today? I used to think that our problems were going to be English, Spanish, Lao, Hmong, you know. It didn't turn out to be that at all. I think Jacobs, I'm president and CEO of the Jacobs Family Foundation and the Jacobs Center for Neighborhood Innovation. And we are a small foundation, as foundations go, although, like Tracy, we've discovered you can do an awful lot of community change without resources, other than the talent and the brilliance of people on the streets. And the Jacobs Center is a neighborhood strengthening organization. We started doing nonprofit capacity building. And the Jacobs Family Foundation started as a funder in youth at risk primarily, and some work around economic development, but very narrowly defined as access to capital for micro entrepreneurs with a focus on seeding those programs in the U.S. And we had at that time a very long list of things we didn't fund, as many funders do, most funders do. Their lists of what they don't do are always longer than what they do. And health, of course, happened to be on that list of things that we would not engage in. But it's kind of like a funny thing happened on the way to the forum or something. We were working nationally and internationally, and we had this moment, I'll never forget it. I was in Cairo because we had a team there that covered the Middle East and Northern Africa. And we were going out to some of the real high concentrated poverty areas surrounding Cairo. And when you got out into those villages, you would very, very often see a big economic project just kind of plopped in a village by USAID or some other major funder and abandoned. And when you ask the villagers why, they would always tell you the same story, which is that they never wanted it to begin with. That what they really wanted were goats or, you know, beehives or something that related more to their existence. I even remember this great story about a group of American women architects who ended up in Bosnia after the war, asking the architects there what they most needed, and they were going, you know, we'll send you Architectural Digest, and we'll send you this and that, and finally somebody stopped them and said, you know, what we really need are pencils. That very often you miss the obvious, you know, if you're not asking. And I've got many, many great examples of that. But for us in the foundation world, that's like being on a 12-step program. You know, to decide that you're not going to be the one in the problem-solving role is really hard work. And we just at some point made a vow that we were going to stop doing that and see what happened. And we got ourselves into a partnership with a community. Now, and really with the intent that they were going to teach us what would make us relevant to community change. Because what was clear to us 10 years into our journey and doing lots of grassroots capacity building was that you could easily figure out how to fund a program that could teach Johnny how to read, but you could not find any kind of solution for investing or organization that you could invest in that knew how to get at the underlying conditions of a community that impacted all children's chances of learning how to read. And you could see the interconnectedness of the issues, that we couldn't really help youth who were at risk if we couldn't get jobs, and we couldn't get jobs if we didn't have businesses willing to move in. At some point, we realized the irony of the fact that we wouldn't move in either, and that you couldn't get business to want to come into a community. First of all, if they think people are going to get shot at the trolley stop on Saturday night. And secondly, if there's no physical development that provides synergy for business and how it operates. And it became really clear that you can't do physical development in most communities without an awful lot of political will. And so We knew instinctively that we had to kind of give up our framework and begin to work across issues in a more organic way that would ask people how they wanted to change their communities and revitalize those communities, and to put them in decision-making roles that would keep them from being the people displaced by the very act of cleaning up and fixing up their communities. So that was kind of the conundrum that we were dealing with at the start of this journey. Couple of things happened for me, because you were asking about partnerships and the complexity of working across disciplines and across unlikely partners like banks and organizations and residents from various ethnic groups and funders can be some of the most complex teams to work collaboratively with. In the early days of this, I have to say, I went to Joe Jacobs, who we've lost Joe during this journey, but he was with us at the time, our founder. And I told him that I really wanted money to produce a video, and I was going to call it Buns of Steel, and it wasn't going to be an exercise video. It was going to be the making of Market Creek Plaza. I got my little butt kicked from every direction. It was just absolutely unbelievable. And so my only kind of saving grace was that at some point, Joe promised that if this didn't work out, he would enroll me in the witness protection program. So I was courageous enough to move in. We moved our offices into the southeastern San Diego neighborhoods and began to really ask people. Now, what is, I think, pretty unconventional about Market Creek as a story of building community health is that it is a story about working at the intersections of health and jobs, at that intersection between health and the built environment, between health and the economics of race and place. And while a lot of data heads hate to hear me say this, it's also about working at the intersection of health and hope, and helping people see a better future for themselves that they can step into. And so the journey of Market Creek really is about trying to stop funding programs and trying to figure out what would it look like if people really owned their own change. And it, when you, I used to think about this a lot, because if you think about take smoking as an example, you can go up to your family member that smokes for 10 years saying, you know, you really need to stop that, and it's bad for you, and you can, you know, cite all the cancer statistics, but unless that person owns that change, there's no way that that person is ever going to stop smoking, no matter what you do as an intervention. So, you know, we realize that people have to own their own change from a very, very deep place, and that just coming in and giving a facelift really doesn't change conditions in communities. Was the video called Unnatural Causes? I know there's they've been promoting this video, and if you haven't seen it, I really recommend it. You know, I think that what we found in the Southeastern neighborhoods is the same as is discussed, I think, broadly in that video, which we find in every urban neighborhood, which is that there's just mounting evidence that where you live can predict your health outcomes, and that further, that good health outcomes aren't just about providing access to health care. You know, even though we weren't health funders, we ended up with, you know, really entrenched in the discussions of community health. And where we started, you have to kind of see a bit of it to believe it. And again, maybe this looks like some of the communities that you work in. It was a neighborhood that had suffered long-term disinvestment and major blight. And it was lovingly known as the Four Corners of Death. There were 42 gangs and 9 tagger teams recorded that had territory rights that intersected at the corner that we decided to put our headquarters. There was very little economic activity, which meant that it was very dark after 5 o'clock because there were no lights on. And certainly some of the greatest employment barriers, either transportation, you couldn't get to work, any hubs of employment, but also our schools were reporting 40% dropout rates at the high school around the corner. So, you know, you're really dealing with some pretty entrenched issues. Lots of immigrant groups. It had traditionally been African American, had become a split of African American and Latino, and then over the last 20 years, every major new immigrant group landed in our community for various reasons. So Laotian, Somali, Samoan, Sudanese, a lot of the East African immigrant groups. And many of them were very isolated, very marginalized, very afraid to come out of their homes. The kids, in fact, if you looked at, say, some cultures like the Laotian community, high teen suicide rates. It was a community that was loved by San Diego for dumping unwanted land use, thinking that nobody would notice if they wanted to get something moved from somewhere else. Lots of examples of toxic environments, including this creek and tributary network that ran through this community that had major toxic environmental issues. You can also see it was a floodplain. Now, if you're from the Midwest, you won't kind of understand this, but in California, waterways don't necessarily have water in them. When it rains, it floods. And so when it would come through this community, it would come through concrete channels at 100 miles an hour. And literally, if any kid was ever playing in that waterway, it would quickly be brushed all the way down to the bay. Right before we bought the property that you see here, or one of the properties you see here, a child had just had that experience. The father went in after him, and they both ended up down at the bay. So lots of rough terrain. lots of substandard housing. I'm sure all of your urban neighborhoods experience this, high levels of mold and lead. And not a single supermarket serving 88,000 residents. So if you're on a path for fresh fruits and vegetables, good luck finding one. And if you have limited transportation to begin with, and the closest grocery is called Foodarama, you're not going to find a fresh fruit or a vegetable. What you're going to find, though, at Foodarama, which was a block away from a couple of these scenes, was rats, beehives. They were selling candy in the shape of drug paraphernalia to children. And these were considered the only places to shop. Now, I love this line, to change a system, you have to start everywhere at once. Like, what? So what in the heck do you do? And so we just decided that we were going to move in. And we were going to throw out all of our areas of interest. There wasn't anything that we said that we wouldn't do. We were going to work comprehensively across social, economic, physical, and political boundaries. And also, we were going to work across disciplines and try to bring together San Diego's diverse ethnic communities, because they had been very separated. The gangs, of course, all divided down ethnic lines. We knew we needed a different approach. We were going to partner broadly. I said that was a nightmare, but worth it in the long run. We were going to take on any role that was needed. So we didn't expect to be a developer, but when no developer would return our phone calls, we became one. When no construction company would take the liability of training people on a construction site and to get those jobs and skills into the neighborhood, we became the construction company. When leasing agents wouldn't return our calls, we became the leasing agents. To get anchor tenants, and the story went on. So we ended up doing just about anything. As our partners have gotten stronger, then we are also good at letting go of roles that we're no longer needed for. But most importantly, we're going to listen to all voices and to work through resident teams. And I want to just keep repeating this thing about people owning their own change. That I saw this wonderful example even just recently where one of our funding partners in health actually wanted to distribute a brochure about access to translators in healthcare and their right to have translators. And so they asked our international outreach team to distribute these within their cultural groups. It was interesting because the minute they looked at it, they said, this is not going to get the outcome that you really want from this. It's too confusing. We don't understand the language. It doesn't tell us what the next steps are or what we do if we need somebody's help. And it took the Health Foundation back to the table with the help of community residents, to regroup and to think through what strategy would be more effective by each of those groups. This was our loving starting point. This was the old Langley factory. And I'll just show you a little bit of what happened.
Interviewed people on the street. Not only that, they came to our neighborhood meetings and they told us what they would like to do. And they ask even the group, what would you like to see here?
I really thought that it was the first opportunity that we had ever had as a neighborhood to go out or to have someone ask us what we wanted to have, not just to build it, and they will come.
This is our project to do together.
This was a toxic brownfield.
The more that you...
Uh-oh. What did I do? Oh. I'm sorry. I hit the... I was trying to get the mic working here.
They came to our house. Knocked on the door. Interviewed us. They interviewed people on the street. Not only that, they came to our neighborhood meetings. and they told us what they would like to do, and they asked even the group, what would you like to see here?
I really thought that it was the first opportunity that we had ever had as a neighborhood to go out or to have someone ask us what we wanted to have, not just to build it, and they will come.
This is our project to do together.
The more that you involve community, people and members into the plan, the more that they feel attached to something. And the more that they feel attached to their community, the more they are to bring pride, you know, ownership.
For the first time in our own neighborhood, look like we're going to get an opportunity to play a role as the major builders, and we thank God for that opportunity.
From the grocery now to a major. Oops, can you hear me? Okay, sorry. Technically challenged here. It's now the energy of the working teams is now targeted about 45 to 50 acres of blighted land surrounding the starting point. And plans have now blossomed out to this whole village. It started as a plaza, but now it's a whole village. And two key learnings that I wanted to share is just to repeat this, what happens when people own their own change. One is that by organizing residents into teams, the very planning of how they wanted to improve their neighborhood changed their own lives. And it did that through building a sense of vision and a sense of hope, and being able to see that they could be active players in community change and leaders in that change. By owning the implementation and by us stepping out of the way and letting them do the actual building of what's gone on is where the skills and capacity have been left behind, which we think are important to sustainability. And then lastly, as I mentioned, the IPO, we felt that it's also important to connect the asset building field to everything else that's going on, and that I know you know the line about give a man a fish and he'll eat today and teach a man a fish, he'll eat for a lifetime, but at some point we started realizing that unless we taught him how to buy the pond and stock it, that we weren't going to be able to impact the next generation. So it was important to leave behind assets that were owned and controlled in the neighborhood by residents that could be leveraged for future change. And then secondly, that lesson of connecting, linking, and leveraging momentum, and that teams are needed in communities that can do that cross-connecting, that civic engagement was critical to raise expectations for change and to allow people to have a voice in that. That started impacting health, the cultures. When they started coming together, crime rates went down. The arts started engaging the graffiti artists within the gangs, and now there's a whole graffiti art park where kids are doing graphic design and poster print and muraling. It's impacted the schools in coming together. There's six or seven youth working teams now that are working on different things. Certainly getting rid of the toxic environments and building construction capacity that knows how to do wetlands recovery work. All of these things have really come together through this project. And in many ways, we feel like we're just at the beginning of really understanding how this can happen. What emerged, of course, I'll just run through quickly. They got the first grocery in 35 years. The creek and the Brownsfield, all are improved. People wanted sidewalks and walking paths, and I'm going to call Tracy on Monday to get her out there. And over 3,000 people came together. It was like a huge barn raising. And I think one of the things we all know intuitively is that when community residents connect, when neighbors connect, they're safer, better places to live. There were kids on us that were involved with the Science Institute. This group had never raised $80,000, and they ran a $6 million campaign for a new science center. And the youth are the leaders on these commissions for health, water, and energy, and the issues they care about in their future. It's been declared neutral territory by the gangs. There's safe passage and prisoner reentry teams at work on staked out on corners. The youth teams I mentioned, there's now school-based obesity and fitness programs that didn't exist. And child care enhancement, which is really training child care workers broadly to improve their child development skills. A medical center got renovated. It couldn't get financing until the blight started being removed and now has been able to expand. The coalitions of neighborhood councils have launched their Walk to the Moon and are encouraging residents to participate in physical activity now where they couldn't have gone out of their homes previously. And really the schools now coming together are really helping these counseling services be centralized. $40 million in economic activity return, 400 new jobs, 34 housing units removed with 800 in the planning. And, of course, just a reduction in various types of crime.
We had a vision. It was built. And now this community owns it. And so it's something that we can take out to the world and say, hey, look, you can do this too. For communities that they call underserved or unempowered, look how powerful you can be.
I can now vouch for Jennifer Vanica as being one of the most brilliant public health minds I have ever witnessed. And I mean that. If I ever had to try to sum up what the new public health was, the public health of the 21st century, that's it. I mean, that is it. We need a Marshall Plan for so many communities in our country, and this is the roadmap to doing that. You're practicing public health. you are. Thank you very much. So let's keep moving here. The next speaker is Terry Hill, who is the, I left my little cheat sheet there, but I believe the chief medical officer for the Prison Receivership Corporation still. Is that correct? I know Terry from Oakland and some public health work there. And hopefully we can have Terry talk about,
We have vision.
We can have Terry talk about the challenges of the prison health population and how that integrates with the community, and then allow for some back and forth for our excellent panel.